who have prevented what has occurred?
There are a number of good international agreements in place that do now, you know, limit at least the number of nuclear weapons that people have, although not everyone is a party to them. But I think if after the United States had made the first weapons, we all agreed, the world agreed, this is not something we want on the planet, then you could have had international agreements in that direction instead. I don't know how likely that would be given how humans are, but it's the kind of thing we've done for biological and chemical weapons, which people don't use theoretically. And so theoretically, you could have done the same for nuclear weapons before they had proliferated so much.
The first A-bomb test was in New Mexico on July 16th, 1945. Its code name was Trinity. Interesting, using a word, you know, loaded with Christian theology. It was the culmination of the top secret Manhattan Project. J. Robert Oppenheimer, the lead scientist at the time, famously thought, "Now I have become death, the destroyer of worlds," a quote from Hindu scripture. He also said, "We knew the world would not be the same." Talk about an understatement. And it's been nothing short of a miracle, again, a kind of religious word, that either intentionally or unintentionally, we have not destroyed the planet.
Yeah, it is remarkable that we've been living with these bombs for so long and no one has dropped another one, you know, in a conflict or been an accident. But I think that the difficult thing about nuclear weapons is there's no guarantee that holds forever. You know, a lot of people have the idea that if I have nuclear weapons and you have nuclear weapons, we won't attack each other because we're afraid of retaliation. No one knows whether that is will be true for forever, and it seems unlikely that it will be.
Well, the deterrence doctrine was part of U.S. military strategy since the end of World War II. But it seems that Vladimir Putin in Ukraine flipped that on its head.
Yeah, it does seem that way. But, you know, because Ukraine did not have nuclear weapons and everyone else was afraid of Putin's nuclear weapons to some reasonable degree, it allows Russia more latitude, I think, than it would have had otherwise, especially since he has given implicit and pretty explicit nuclear threats. And so I think, you know, nobody wants to start World War III. And so I think that partly determines how other countries decide to intervene or not.
In the early days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Putin warned if anyone tried to intervene that, I'm quoting, "Russia will respond immediately and the consequences will be such as you have never seen in your entire history," unquote. That's pretty scary.
Yeah, that's very scary. And I think depending on who you ask, it's kind of an example of what experts call compellence, which is kind of the flip side, like you said, of deterrence, of compelling other nations to do what you want them to do using your nuclear weapons, kind of bullying them into getting what you want.
And speaking of Ukraine, there's a nuclear reactor at Zaporizhia that worried the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency. That threat seems to have gone down quite a bit. But what about accidents at these so-called peaceful reactors like Fukushima, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island?
Right. Yeah, I mean, anything with radioactive material something can go wrong with it or someone can attack it. And while it might not pose the same level of risk as a full-scale nuclear weapon with a critical reaction going on, it certainly is not good. And I think, you know, nuclear anything has a certain kind of taboo is quite the right word, but it's reasonably more scary than other, maybe more conventional things. And I think that holds whether it's a nuclear power plant being, you know, repurposed as a weapon or a weapon itself.
Well, talk about, you know, these safety concerns around reactors and the weapons systems themselves. For example, at the LANL, Los Alamos National Lab, the Cerro Grande fire in the year 2000 came very close to the buildings. There's apparently earthquake danger in Los Alamos. There was flood incidents and even a breach. So what about safety issues and the storage of radioactive waste and plutonium in underground locations?
Most, if not all, nuclear sites in the U.S., which is this largely the system that they call the national labs, which are in charge of maintaining the arsenal, have been around for a long time, including times when there were many fewer environmental regulations than there are now. And so they have a large amount of leftover contamination and, you know, probably some newer contamination that they have created. And so things like the Cerro Grande fire that you mentioned was encroaching on land that, you know, contained at least legacy radioactive contamination that could have been, you know, thrust up into the air during the wildfire. And that is scary. And I mean, I think whether you're working with radioactive material, you have leftover contamination, or you're storing waste, like no matter what it is, there is always some amount of risk to human health and the environment.
And in multiple ways, it seems, you know, New Mexico is ground zero for a lot of this, particularly I'm thinking of the Carlsbad Cavern, where radioactive waste has been stored supposedly safely.
Mm-hmm. They have that storage facility. There's a national lab called Sandia outside of Albuquerque and then Los Alamos. So, but they have had a large accident there. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but I believe it was 2014, there was some waste from Los Alamos that was stored improperly. It was supposed to be stored with a certain kind of kitty litter to kind of neutralize it, and it was stored with a different kind, and it essentially became a dirty bomb underground that released contamination and shut the site down for multiple years.
The Los Alamos National Laboratory, LANL, in New Mexico is about 30 miles from Santa Fe. And that's where, in the 1940s, Oppenheimer and his crew of scientists worked on the bomb, the Manhattan Project. The lab's stated mission is, I'm quoting, to solve national security challenges through simultaneous excellence. I had a little trouble understanding the words there. Can you help me out?
If I had to hazard a guess, I would guess that they mean excellence across all of the disciplines that they work in. So, you know, all the different kinds of physics and engineering all has to come together inside a nuclear weapon to make it what they like to say there is safe, secure, and reliable.
Talk about the people that you talk to there. You say they like to discuss, I'm quoting, easily palatable, press-releasable science. What's the PR around LANL and the system in general? And given their spin, how were you able to carry out your investigations?
Yeah, I believe the latest figure is that 70% of LANL's budget goes to nuclear weapons, but most of the things they talk or write about in public are about basic science, like, you know, climate change or how pandemics spread or how did you work on Mars or how does a supernova work? And those are often the things that do make it into the press releases, in part because it's not the kind of stuff that makes people mad, and also because it's not classified. And so you can talk about it. And, you know, I wrote a thing or two about that and met some interesting scientists. And I could tell that underneath that research that they were doing on those sciences, it had some applicability to weapons. And so I said, you know, we've talked about your supernova. I want to talk about what you do for weapons now. And, you know, they did things like check my background a lot and make me. But eventually they agreed to give me access to the facility and to the scientists.
Talk about modernization of the whole range of weapons. Why has the U.S. undertaken the largest and most expensive ever modernization program? And I presume it's a bipartisan affair among our political rulers that will cost tons of money. Any price tag numbers yet?
The price tag numbers are always in flux, but I think it's safe to say between $1 and $2 trillion over about 30 years. And yes, it is bipartisan. It has gone through multiple administrations' policies on nuclear weapons. And so modernization involves taking weapons that we built, you know, mostly decades, in some cases many decades ago, and sometimes upgrading really sort of basic components like, you know, electronics or fuses or things like that. In some cases, changing out the regular explosives that are inside nuclear weapons to ones that are less sensitive to things like dropping or fire or things like that. In other cases, it means, you know, right now we're designing the first new nuclear weapon that we have designed in decades. We haven't added any new weapons to the arsenal in a long time. And we are also creating these things called plutonium pits. And these are spheres of plutonium that are at the center of modern nuclear weapons. And they kind of set off the larger bomb. They're surrounded by conventional explosives. Those explosives go off, squish the plutonium, and start the critical reaction that then ignites fusion. And so we're making more of those. And let's see, you asked about the motivation for it. So the part of the motivation is, you know, you wouldn't buy a car in 1980, never take it out of the garage, and expect it to drive the way that it did when you bought it, which, you know, makes it all sound very reasonable that you would want to replace some parts to ensure that the weapons are safe and not going to do something we don't expect. But also from the defense side, you know, they want to make sure that they work the way they are expected to and are as efficient and effective as they're expected to be if they're used, which is also, you know, disturbing to think about them being used. But across the world, other countries are, you know, either working on acquiring more nuclear weapons, like China is increasing its arsenal and Russia is modernizing its arsenal. And so the idea is that you want to be able to match what other countries are doing. On the other side, people might say, you know, it's good business for the labs. It's a big project and it's internationally provocative to starting the arms race all over instead of decreasing dependence.
In your Scientific American article, you have a remarkable photograph here that I'd like you to tell our listeners about.
Let's see.
It's not too far from where we're sitting here.
Right.
You're in Boulder, Colorado, and that photograph is?
It's at F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. So if we just drive a few hours north, we would be right there. And it's a picture of three intercontinental ballistic missiles standing next to each other, decreasing in size. The Peacekeeper, the Minuteman III, and the Minuteman I, and they are just hanging out in Wyoming.
George Orwell would have loved that Peacekeeper.
The Peacekeeper, yes. Uh-huh.
2025 will mark 80 years since we entered the so-called, what is called the nuclear age. Nine countries possess nuclear weapons, the U.S., Russia, France, China, and the United Kingdom, essentially the entire Security Council at the U.N. And then there's Pakistan, India, Israel, and North Korea. And I should add that Israel has never admitted it has nukes. That seems to be an off-limits subject for the media and Washington politicians. In total, the global nuclear stockpile is close to 13,000 weapons. Do you think that's enough?
I think that's plenty, yeah.
Why so many?
It is, you know, I think the highest number of nuclear weapons that's been on the planet is 70,000, which is kind of incredible to think about. But I think it comes from every country that has nuclear weapons just wanting to feel like they can match or best everybody else. And, you know, that is an arms race that increases the number until you have some kind of agreement like, okay, we're going to stop making more. But I mean, you're right. We definitely have enough to get whatever job done that we want to have done, which hopefully is not a job we ever want to do.
And I should add that, you know, countries like South Korea and Saudi Arabia seem to be very interested in acquiring these weapons of mass destruction. And hardly a day goes by when there isn't some word linking Iran to the development of weapons. But there is this constant danger of proliferation. You know, we saw that with A.Q. Khan of Pakistan, who worked with North Korea in developing their weapons. So the knowledge is proliferating, and more states will climb on board the bandwagon.
It's essentially 80-year-old science that people don't need to have access to classified information, really, to be able to design and build a nuclear weapon, having the infrastructure to actually do it. That's the actual hard part. And having your own nuclear weapons is a more attractive prospect to a lot of, maybe not a lot of countries, to some countries than it has been in the past, when maybe non-proliferation was more more on the table. Because with countries invading other countries in a ground war sort of way that hasn't exactly happened on the scale that we're seeing it recently, like if Ukraine had nuclear weapons, would Russia have done what it did? And I think, you know, a lot of people say the answer is no. And so from that perspective, everybody wants their own, because then you can stop that kind of thing, theoretically. But then that's how you end up back in a world with 70,000 nuclear weapons.
You say that secrecy has always been a big part of the story, for obvious reasons, but explain why.
From the beginning, starting with the Manhattan Project, which was meant to be a very secret project, I think it is, in fact, a little less secret than we talk about it now. But the idea is that at that time, people can't know we're working on this weapon so that we can beat them to making one. And ever since then, it has also been about, you know, beating other countries in some way, or having the best in a way that they don't have. And so atomic information is some of the most highly protected information in the government. The Atomic Energy Act classifies all nuclear weapons relevant information of a certain sort as born classified. So if you write something down about a nuclear weapon, you don't have to classify it. It's classified just by existing. And so that has been true since the 1950s, which is kind of wild, but does make it hard for, you know, you and me and everybody listening right now to know things like the details of the modernization program or what is going on, just because so many of those details remain classified.
With rapidly developing AI, is there a danger there?
There is kind of hypothetical talk about turning over some of the nuclear decision-making process over to AI, whether that's analyzing the data that indicates whether someone else has launched nuclear weapons, or, you know, on the extreme end, letting an AI make the decision about whether to launch a nuclear weapon. I think fundamentally the defense apparatus is kind of conservative with the technology it adopts. And so I think it'll be at least a while before we see that. But where AI is already showing up is in a program called Stockpile Stewardship, which is taking the nuclear weapons that we do have, you know, whose age we are worried about, and trying to understand what's going on inside those aging weapons. And that involves a lot of supercomputer simulation and right now kind of investigating how AI could play a role in understanding that sort of physics.
Reagan and Gorbachev said, quoting, "A nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought." That was in 1985. 6 years later, the Soviet Union collapsed. Was there a space then for eliminating weapons of mass destruction? There was some talk of a peace dividend at that time, you may recall, which never really materialized.
Mm-hmm.
There was some reduction in weapons,
mm-hmm.
but not substantial.
It's hard to say, in hindsight is always 2020, that maybe that was a good moment to have done that. But I mean, that's a pretty remarkable statement that they would get together and say that, these two countries in conflict.
And particularly with Reagan, with his reputation of being a hawk.
Right, yes. But I mean, I think most people would agree that they're right. Nobody wins in a nuclear war. And in an ideal world, we would never have one. Treaties have come along, like the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which kind of commits the countries who have signed it either to not acquire nuclear weapons if they don't have them, or to decrease their dependence on them with the idea of eventually eliminating them. We also have the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty that means that we don't blow up weapons just to test them. And so there was a lot of this stuff in the air that would have indicated that, you know, we could have moved more in that direction than we have. And it seems like we're moving in the opposite direction.
And that test ban treaty was for atmospheric detonations, right?
Atmospheric, the one in the 1990s was also for underground testing. No more testing. There was an earlier one for atmospheric testing.
Well, here's an enigma. I mean, if you can't win a nuclear war, as Gorbachev and Reagan say, and everyone agrees with them, why have the weapons? Why take the risk?
Yeah. You know, it is hard from an international dynamics perspective to get anyone to agree to get rid of nuclear weapons if other countries are not, and getting everyone to agree to do it in the same way at the same time is no easy feat. And so I think the philosophy that at least the U.S. has come to is that having nuclear weapons prevents nuclear war, which is kind of contradictory. But if you have nuclear weapons, they're so bad that they can't ever be used, and so no one would initiate someone else's use, and so nuclear war won't happen because we have this deterrence going on. But as a scientist named Brad Roberts, who works at Lawrence Livermore, told me, as long as deterrence is unstable and unpredictable, which he agreed that it was, we should move toward disarmament, getting rid of the weapons. And as long as disarmament isn't happening tomorrow, we need deterrence to keep the peace. And I think that within the national labs and the defense apparatus, that would be what they would say.
To keep the peace, there are wars breaking out.
Right. I know. Just the past few years have really tested that idea of nuclear deterrence, what it's worth, and how it's working in the real world.
Since you wrote Countdown, what new developments have occurred that we should know about?
This plutonium pit production that we were talking about earlier is moving forward. Both the lab at Los Alamos and the Savannah River site in South Carolina are in the process of hiring thousands of people who are going to work literally 24/7 to be building these 80 plutonium pits a year. And to me, I think that's the biggest thing that has been going forward, just because it's such a large part of the ongoing program and something we haven't done since 1989.
Tell me more about the scientists that you talk to at Los Alamos and elsewhere. How do they go about justifying what they're doing? I mean, producing weapons of mass destruction that can end life on Earth as we know it.
I think for the most part, you know, everyone makes sense of their job and what they're adding to the world. And so they have made sense of their job and what they're adding to the world through this idea of deterrence in some ways, that, you know, they believe they're working on a system that does keep the peace. And, you know, we could all agree with that or not. But in some cases, they see themselves as being part of creating world stability. On the other hand, the other scientists also at the labs say what you just said, which is that actually the world is not very stable. And this is not a trustworthy or reliable idea. And we shouldn't hold ourselves at constant nuclear peril. However, I think they all agree that nuclear weapons exist. The United States is unlikely to get rid of theirs tomorrow. And so while they exist, someone needs to be kind of overseeing them and keeping them up and making sure, you know, they are not dangerous of course they're dangerous, but making sure they're safe, secure, and reliable. And so that is the other attitude. But there's also a lot of scientists who work at the national labs who do work in non-proliferation, in trying to scale back or at least keep steady the number of nuclear weapons in the world and making sure no one is testing them or blowing them up. And so it's kind of this two-headed thing of people who work on weapons at the same labs as people who work on making sure that there are as few weapons as possible.
Well, of course, I have to ask you about the award-winning movie Oppenheimer.
Of course.
Your critique of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think Oppenheimer as a whole was fundamentally good at introducing people to maybe some of the issues around nuclear weapons and some of the existential questions like, you know, what does it mean to work on them? And what does it mean to decide to use them? And how does that weigh on the people who are part of that? And, you know, how did the Manhattan Project work? And I think, you know, a lot of people probably hadn't thought about that in a deep way in a while. And so it made it more popular. On the other hand, the things that the movie doesn't show are things like how people were affected by the test and then ultimately, you know, died in Japan because of the weapons that were dropped. It was a focus mostly on this guy who was working on the programs and not on how the programs affected people.
And his peculiar angst. He was clearly a conflicted character because here he was creating something, which is very exciting for anyone, a scientist and in particular, inventing the bomb, but then ultimately losing control over his invention and losing government security clearance.
Right. Yeah, I think there's a historian I talked to for the book named Audra Wolfe, who says that since the Manhattan Project, physicists have gotten better at thinking through the implications of their work because of things like the Manhattan Project, but they still haven't quite taken the lesson that they don't really have any political power over what happens to their research after it's done, which Robert Oppenheimer also had to learn. Like, you lose control of the creation. A lot of scientists still think they might have some more control over the creation than they do.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Sarah Scholes on nuclear weapons and the future of the planet. I talked with her in late February in Boulder, Colorado. Sarah Scholes is an award-winning science journalist and author of Countdown, The Blinding Future of Nuclear Weapons. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Arundhati Roy, Ralph Nader, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Sarah Scholes on Nuclear Weapons and the Future of the Planet, and for her book, Countdown, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Boulder Bookstore and KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Streaming for Survivors 2024 is right around the corner. From March 23rd to 30th, content creators, gamers, artists, tabletop RPG players, musicians, streamers, and podcasters will come together with the goal of raising $80,000 for survivors of sexualized violence during Salal Sexual Violence Support Center's 4th annual Streaming for Survivors event. All week long, participants will use their platforms to inspire their followers and communities to donate to survivors and fund Salal's life-saving sexual violence support services. Sexualized violence and misconduct plague our online communities. By participating in Streaming for Survivors, you are not only supporting more than 500 individuals currently accessing Salal's programs and services, but committing to creating safer digital spaces for people of all genders. More information can be found at www.salalsvsc.ca/s4s. Oh,
podcast.